Welcome to the October 9th edition of This Week in Palestine on WZBC 90.3 FM, a weekly show hosted for many years by our beloved Sharif Fahm and continued in his loving memory by a group of his dedicated friends. I'm your host, Vespina Mutzuz. Today's show will feature an interview with a young Palestinian blogger from the Gaza Strip, Rana Bakr. You can follow her blog postings at http://rana, RANABAKER.wordpress.com. Rana Bakr is a 20-year-old student from the Gaza Strip. She is currently studying business administration and works as a freelance writer. She has lived all her life in Gaza but has managed to travel for a few weeks to other parts of the Arab world and Europe. Welcome, Rana, to our show. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, Rana. I'd like to start our conversation this morning by asking you when you started blogging on the Internet.
I actually started blogging for the first time in June 2010, a year and a half after the war in Gaza.
What motivated you to express yourself in this way, apart, of course, from the brutal attack on Gaza at that time?
When Israel attacked Gaza in winter 2008, people were being killed and massacres were committed few blocks from home. I was, however, cowering underneath my bed cover and praying for safety. And at the same point, my sense of severe inability suffocated me, and I was like dying from the inside. So when Israel's aggression came to an end in January 2009, I went out to the streets and saw the destruction and death as they encapsulated 1.5 million humans. I saw what white phosphorus had done to children and how mothers lost sanity at the loss of their kids. I also saw complicity of the international community and the insignificance of our lives in the world powers' calculations. I later on became involved in politics for the first time in my life, and my reading list became so long and largely political that I started to blog. So that's how everything started.
And in terms of one of your first blogs, what did you write about, or what did you feel the need to write about at that time?
I started blogging about life in Gaza, the life of the people of Gaza under occupation, my diaries during the war, my diaries when I go to university, how everything goes, when Israel bombs Gaza. So basically, I try to write my diaries, but against a political background.
Exactly. And why do you think using these various kinds of social media, the blogs, Twitter, is popular among your generation in Palestine?
Basically because Internet is the only way for Palestinians, and particularly the people of besieged Gaza. When Israel imposed a siege on the Strip in 2007, Gazans lost connection with the rest of the world. We were, and still are, denied our right to leave our country and get back to it as frequently or infrequently as we wish. Israel murders Palestinians and destroys civilian property on a daily basis, yet little, if any, is reported about human rights violations in the mainstream media. Therefore, we, the young people of Gaza, found ourselves faced by two options: to either wait until mainstream media and international community decide to stand for justice in Palestine, or act immediately and write about our lives under occupation, which in all form is a form of peaceful resistance to the unpeaceful Israeli approaches toward the Palestinians. Undoubtedly, the second was our choice.
So in a way, blogging and using Twitter as a way of creating your own media and breaking through that news blockade, the news that we actually don't get in the United States, especially about Gaza.
Exactly.
How does the act of writing help you deal with the situation in Palestine?
Actually, it helps a lot, especially with the ongoing Israeli domination of Western media. Media get peacekeepers in the U.S. especially and in many parts across Europe provide a shield to Israel's racist policies enforced upon the Palestinians. By reporting our life under occupation and the constant targeting and humiliation of civilians, we allow the world a credible source for which they can find out about Israel's policy of systemized ethnic cleansing and racial discrimination, unlike what campaigns like Brand Israel, say, try to promote.
Exactly. And what is your opinion of the Palestinian Authority's recent bid for statehood at the UN? How do you think young people like yourself feel about this initiative in Gaza?
Well, I actually think it's a good move because Abbas has finally understood that negotiations are useless. But I really wish he consulted with the majority of Palestinians who were refugees scattered across refugee camps in Jordan, Lebanon, and parts of Europe. Regarding people of Gaza, there are diverse opinions among the young people here. Some tend to believe that having a state would strengthen our position in the international community and that having a state based on the 1967 borders is better than not having one at all. Others, including myself, believe that the quest for full membership in the UN based on the 1967 lines ignores the basic rights of the Palestinians, above them all the right to return according to UN Resolution 194. If the bid was approved, we will not live in an independent state, I believe. Rather, we will live in independent boundary stands.
Yeah, and you know that actually has been an opinion that's been expressed many times. We've had several shows concerning the UN recent bid, and considering now that you know the Security Council has the application, what do you feel will happen with that? Will anything be done, or will it just sit there and no action be taken, or a negative action be taken in the future?
Well, I don't think that the U.S. will allow this to happen or to be approved. I think that the Obama administration will veto the bid. And therefore, I think that we will be faced by the remaining solution, which is the one-state solution. And I think it is a viable solution because it allows all people, Palestinians and Israeli Jews, equal rights and freedom. So what is going to happen after Obama vetoes this bid is basically, I think, that we should all work toward achieving the one-state solution.
And what actions do you see that people of your generation or yourself taking to make this one-state solution a reality?
Well, actually, we try to work on BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions, because we think that boycott, divestment, sanctions has the power and ability to isolate Israel internationally. And by isolating Israel, we will actually force it to accept a one-state solution. And sometimes I hear that, you know, Israelis believe that a one-state solution means the end of Israel or the elimination of the Israeli state. Mm-hmm. And this is basically wrong because the one-state solution is based on equal rights for everybody, for Palestinians, for Israeli Jews, and everybody will be allowed to keep his or her culture, religion, and beliefs and everything. So I don't think that it is right to say that the one-state solution is discriminates between Palestinians and Israelis. Instead, I believe that this is what a two-state solution does because it ignores the basic rights of the Palestinians, the right to return, the end of occupation, and because we will still have Israeli settlements sneaking through the West Bank, and this is not a viable state, and this will not stop, say, resistance against the Israeli occupation.
And that that definitely is true. I remember recently on one of your blogs, someone had responded that you were writing about the eradication of Israel. But I think what Israel is afraid of is that it will lose its dominant position, its right to define itself as a Jewish state. But it does that, it ignores millions of people. I know that there are, many bloggers from Gaza and other parts of Palestine, and each of you, write individually. You have your individual issues that that you're passionate about, but do you ever, like, for example, get together with any of your friends who blog to discuss different things, or that's not done?
Yeah, we discuss this frequently. We hang out together, and ultimately this topic is usually open because it is really the concern of everybody here. Everybody is thinking about the next step, about what is going to happen. So we always try to discuss the advantages and the disadvantages of this bid. And I can't say that everybody agrees with the one-state solution, but at the same time, not everybody agrees with the two-state solution, because the majority of the Gazan people are refugees, and refugees really want to go back to their land, and they believe that the two-state solution will not allow them to exercise this right. So discussion is everywhere in Gaza, wherever we go and every time.
That's good to hear. And aside from the blogging, of course, that gives you your voice and your expression, what other types of actions have you personally taken and people of your generation have taken to change the situation in Palestine?
Basically, we try to focus on peaceful resistance. The majority of the young people of Gaza believe in the peaceful resistance, in blogging, in writing, in tweeting, and protesting, and actually the Arab Spring was inspired many of us. We try now to go out, protest anything we do not like. For example, every Tuesday we go out and protest the buffer zone in Gaza, the Israeli buffer zone, and we try to press, you know, Israel to, like, allow Palestinians to exercise the rights to, for example, leave Gaza and go to Jerusalem side, because we are denied this right. And it doesn't make sense that you are a Palestinian and you cannot go to your capital, to Jerusalem. So, I mean, the people of Egypt can go from Alexandria to Cairo, but we cannot go to Jerusalem. It just doesn't make sense. So we're working toward that. We work in BDS. Others will work in advocacy groups. Others try to understand and study international humanitarian law and engage themselves in courses or such sorts of activities.
Mm-hmm. And I know currently you are studying business in college or in university. How do you plan to use your knowledge in the future to help Palestine?
I think the first thing I would try to look is to strengthen the economy of the Palestinian people. I know it is relatively hard to achieve that, but I am trying because I am basically involved in BDS, in the Gaza-based BDS. So I want to encourage people to purchase and to buy the local products here. Maybe I will just come out with strategies and plans to improve the local Palestinian products, and therefore it will be easier for the people of Gaza to boycott the Israeli products, because the money that we pay for the Israelis goes for ballots, goes for settlements, for missiles, for F-16. So this is what I really want to do in the future, inshallah.
Certainly, and we wish you the best of luck on that. Currently, what is the situation like in Gaza? What is daily life like for most people, and how difficult is it to actually get out of Gaza or come into Gaza?
It is almost impossible to get out of Gaza, because even though the mainstream media said that the people of Gaza can now leave and the Rafah crossing is eventually open, this is definitely not true, because we cannot leave Gaza. And I recently tried to leave Gaza to go to Egypt, and I was not able to do that. My colleagues also, I don't know if you heard about that, but many people were invited to bloggers to Tunisia, but they were not allowed visas. So there are restrictions everywhere, but this does not mean, of course, that the people of Gaza are suffering, because I think that the problem of Palestine is not a humanitarian problem, it is a political problem. So when people send us aid and send us food, of course this helps to some extent, but this is not the solution of our problem. The solution of our problem is to be granted our full rights in full. So it is difficult, but people here are trying to read, are trying to educate themselves, and I think that we can overcome these obstacles as long as we have the intention to do so.
And I'm glad that you brought up that point because, you know, aid is helpful, but of course, you know, you don't want to become dependent. You want to become free and independent. So I'm glad that you actually mentioned that point. But just getting back to the difficulty of getting out of Gaza, how far in advance does someone have to apply for, like, a permit to leave? And usually what are the reasons that are given for denial, or do you ever get a reason why you're denied?
Most of the times you're not given a reason at all. You're just denied visas, or you are accused to be, like, involved with resistance groups in Gaza. Sometimes because you are really active and they think that, for example, maybe you would pose danger, maybe you would incite people to take action outside. So basically, such sort of pretexts are usually put in front of us. And even if you try to deny this and provide a proof that you're not involved with the resistance, you're still a Gazan, and we are denied most of our rights because sometimes you are accused to be, because this is what they say. They say you elected Hamas, so this is how everything should go. You should be punished because you elected Hamas.
And from your, now that you mentioned Hamas, from your viewpoint, your standpoint, has the Hamas government been successful at all to make any change in Gaza, or have things not changed much, or are they unable to make certain changes? What is your opinion about that?
First, one fact I want to point out is that Hamas was democratically elected. This means that no power on earth and the U.S. and Israel do not have the right to say whatever they want to say about the people of Gaza or about Hamas, or to punish us collectively as is happening. Hamas was not actually given a chance to improve their situation in Gaza because since it has been elected, the siege was imposed. The people of Gaza were denied the freedom of movement, were denied aid and many, many, many things. So I don't think that Hamas was really successful if we're talking about its achievement. It's political achievements. But if we're talking about, say, security, I think that things have improved regarding security and the lives of people. I know maybe you are surprised because this is different from what is broadcasted outside, but this is the truth. Second point is that many people tend to say that Hamas persecutes women and denies them the right, for example, to go out without a headscarf. And this is wrong. I personally go out in Gaza without a headscarf and wear whatever I want. And I am not the only person. There are many, many young girls who go out without wearing a headscarf or without wearing the Islamic, Islamic clothes. Yeah.
Yeah, and the reason I was asking that question is because we get so little news from Gaza at all. We just hear nothing. And so I appreciate, the reason I asked that question is to give us, you know, a view of what's actually going on inside of Gaza. A few months back, a website was created called When I Return, and it was set up to ask two questions, one from Palestinians in the diaspora and one from Palestinians in Palestine. And so the question I'd like to pose to you is, when Palestine is liberated, what will you do? How would you answer that question?
Well, actually, I will dance in the street.
That's an honest reaction. And after dancing, what will you do then?
Well, I think that I will make sure Israeli Jews realize that we would not be willing to take them out of the land as they did to us. Instead, we would welcome them to live with us side by side in peace and harmony and equal rights for everyone, exactly as what a one-state solution suggests.
And as we come towards the end of our interview, do you have any other thoughts or any other things that you'd like to say to our listeners or to Americans in general about people in Gaza or about Gaza or even about yourself?
Of course, I would like to thank you very much for allowing me to speak today. And I really appreciate that you have such sort of programs dedicated especially for Palestine, because the people of Gaza and the people of Palestine really need this sort of activities, because we know what is going on in the U.S. We know that Zionists are controlling mainstream media. So it is really helpful that you allow people from Gaza to speak out and to help people understand the truth and hear directly from people living inside Gaza, not from politicians, not from parliamentaries, but from the people themselves. So I think that this is really good, and I really appreciate this. I encourage you for more and more work like this.
Yes, exactly. I mean, and that's part of the reason why this show even exists and why it has been in existence for 5 years. And it has not been easy to keep the Palestinian voice on the air, but we've done everything that we can. I don't know if you're aware, but we actually have a Palestinian Film Festival that actually is in its fifth year this year that will be going on starting October 21st. So, the Palestinian voice has become more and more audible in the United States. And I'd like to thank you, Rana, for joining us, and I hope we can talk to you again in the future. My regards to Gaza.
Inshallah. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And that was Rana Baca from the Gaza Strip, talking about her blogging and living and working and studying in Palestine. And as an epilogue to our interview, I'd actually like to read one of her pieces, and it has to do with something that she mentioned briefly in the interview. It was actually published on May 26th, called My Jerusalem Diaries, and it talks about the first time that she went to Jerusalem. And it begins like this. What a pity being asked if you have ever been to your capital, and all that you utter is a mere, I would love to go there one day, or the last time you had been to it was when you were only 9. There could be a third way to answer this embarrassing question. Yes, you have passed by it, but they didn't let you put a step out of the bus because you did not have a special permit that allows you to do so. I wonder which answer I should opt for, as all of them luckily apply to me. Have I listed all the possible answers? I feel compelled to make you stop at every station and ponder the view as I roam the streets of Jerusalem with my parents and my grandmother and my sister in 2000. Later on, you will ponder me a sample of a typical Palestinian as I cross Beit Hanun border or Erez crossing, as being called nowadays by the Israelis. The first picture my mind summons for Jerusalem was 11 years ago when I was there for the first time. It is the picture of myself staring at a crowd, rabbis through the window of the bus that carried us to Jerusalem. They all were the same, dressed in black outfits and black hats, with straggling beards and two curls dangling from their whiskers. I asked my mother who these were. Her answer was that they were religious Jews. I remember my parents holding my tiny hands as we got out of the bus with my grandmother and my older sister among other tourists, many who were Palestinians just like us. I was too naive to realize that this visit could be the first and the last time I walk in the Holy Land for many years to come. I don't know what happened next, but I remember that we went to the Mosque of Al-Aqsa, where I was fascinated by the grandeur of the Dome of the Rock as it proudly basked in the sun that made it look even more beautiful. I still remember when my mother handed me the prayer rug in the prayer ground and told me to pray. I unrolled the rug, wore the gown, and made my prayer on the yard of Al-Masjid Al-Aqsa under the blue sky of the old city. One, even if only 9, could speak of the serenity of the place, the purity of the atmosphere, and above all, one could feel the genuineness and the depth of the relationship between the Palestinian and the land. A relationship that has been originally created and developed by our ancestors and those who followed. It is the story of ancient Canaan and his Philistia, of a peasant and an olive tree, of the love and tolerance between the crescent and the cross, Generations prior to the desecration of Zion, generations similar to the one that gave birth to Salah al-Din al-Yubi. My mother took me and my sister to see the mosque from the inside. The only part I remember is my mother and my sister, and I taking off our shoes and leaving them on a shoe rack, then entering the mosque where I saw the stone upon which the Prophet Muhammad's sacred feet were printed when he ascended to Allah during the incident of Al-Asra wal Miraj. I remember enjoying the special flavor of Jerusalem reflected upon its Nablusi kanafe, an Arab-Palestinian well-known dessert, at an old shop and one of the souks within Jerusalem's famous Seven Open Gates Old City. The last scene I can summon is my mother, sister, and grandmother trying hard to remember the name of the gate by which we were to meet my father at a particular hour. Al-Katanin, I yelled with ecstasy for being the one who reminded them of the name. They cheered for me. After all, I had to go back to my house in Gaza the same day in accordance to the conditions stipulated on our permits. I was not more than a tourist in my own land. The second trip was in 2007, the year the siege on Gaza was imposed. I was accompanied by a group of young, privileged Palestinians who were given permits to leave Gaza through the Beit Hanun border, travel via the occupied Palestinian territories, the so-called Israel, to Jordan, then fly to Cairo from Amman. It was impossible with Mubarak's regime to spare a lot of humiliation at Erez by allowing us to cross to Egypt directly through the Rafah crossing point. I was the oldest among the group that had been chosen to spend 3 weeks in the Arab digital expression camps in Cairo. Under the Palestinian law and the Israeli law, I suppose, one who has not yet completed 16 years of his or her life and doesn't have an ID card is known to be a minor. Our adult leaders were banned from accompanying us. We were faced by two options, either to withdraw from the trip and spend the summer in Gaza, or to make it from Erez to Jordan on our own. The second option won all votes. To reach Erez, your taxi will have to drop you meters away from the gate. We dragged our feet and pulled our luggage under a hot August sun until we arrived at the gate. Not necessarily a gate like the one you might be picturing. It was more like jail rods than a gate of a crossing point. Beyond the gate, you could see at first glance that the whole area was bugged. Cameras were everywhere to tell you that they are there to punish you if you acted in a way that might bother the Israeli officers. Large posters were glued to the walls to offer millions of dollars to those who will agree to cooperate with Israel and report the location of Shalit, the abducted Israeli soldier. Behind the gate or the jail rods, there was a long fenced road that led to many searching engines at checkpoints. You have to leave your luggage on the machine, take off anything that contains metal, even if it is a necklace, and pass through the checkpoint. If it beamed, you're in trouble. If it didn't, go to the next. One machine was a bit more interesting and much larger than the checkpoints I had gotten used to. It was the one with the X-rays that causes cancer, the one I had always heard about. Once I got inside this machine, I was ordered to raise my hands and stand still through a loudspeaker. The machine, too, was bugged. There was something wrong with me. The woman's voice with a distorted English accent ordered me to get out of the machine and get inside again. She screamed at me, saying that I was not raising my hands the way I should have been doing. She made me go in and out of the machine 5 times. When she let me out, I thought there was no doubt I will get cancer. Through many gates we were then meant to pass. If the gate beamed a green light, push it and go to the next. If it beamed red, what will happen to you is identical to what happened to me. I was taken to a special room with a searching machine, a table, a female officer, and a searching device on the table. The officer ordered me to take off my pants. All of a sudden, I thought I did not understand. "Have you heard me?" she inquired. "Take off your pants and put them in the searching machine," she explained. I was feeling humiliated to the extent that made me force myself to pretend that I'm totally fine with this. She picked the searching device from the table and approached me. "Are you scared?" she sarcastically asked. "No," I retorted, although I was soaking in fear. The device ran across my body. At that point, I was wondering what one could hide under his or her skin or underwear. When she let me out, I found the rest of the group waiting on the bench. I burst out with tears. It was tormenting to an animal, and I was a human. Suddenly, I burst out with laughter. It was the absurdity of the situation. Our luggage was totally unpacked and mixed together. We spent hours separating our stuff and putting them again inside the bags. In the end, we walked out of Erez and rode the bus to the Allenby Bridge that leads to Jordan. In the bus, we screamed out of excitement, of ecstasy, and of shock. We were on the other part of our home. We were in the occupied West Bank. We asked the driver to take us to Jerusalem and let us make our steps on the ground of the Holy Land. Alas, to walk on our land, we needed a permit from the stranger. We could only pass by Jerusalem and see a little spot of the Dome of the Rock. That day, that spot was capable to make me ignore, at least for a while, the treatment I had received at Erez. And thus, we carried to the bridge, Jordan, and eventually flew to Egypt. I still wonder how a minor's body can be threatening to the security and the well-being of the State of Israel, the only democracy in the Middle East. Dear world, I'm a Palestinian. I was born in Palestine, and since then I have lived there. I cannot go to my capital, Jerusalem. Non-Palestinians can go. If I want to go there, I have to ask for a special permit, which I will not be given. Could you please justify this for me? I always fail to clarify it for myself. And so ends the piece by Rana Baca, which I encourage you to take a look at her blog pieces. They're very interesting. And also the other blogs that are online from other young people in Gaza. And as a way of bringing our show to a close today, I'd like to read a piece that was published by British author Jonathan Cook, who is based in Nazareth and in Palestine for many years now, that was published on September 26th. And it speaks about the aftermath of the UN bid. The title is "The UN Bid Heralds Death of Palestine's Old Guard." And it actually relates to our conversation and our discussion today. Amid the enthusiastic applause in New York and the celebrations in Ramallah, it was easy to believe, if only for a minute, that after decades of obstruction by Israel and the United States, a Palestinian state might finally be pulled out of the United Nations hat. Will the world's conscience be midwife to a new era ending Israel's occupation of the Palestinians? It seems not. The Palestinian application handed to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon last week had now disappeared from view, for weeks it seems, while the United States and Israel devise a face-saving formula to kill it in the Security Council. Behind the scenes, the pair are strong-arming the council members to block Palestinian statehood without the need for the U.S. to cast its threatened veto. Whether or not President Barack Obama yields the knife with his own hand, no one is under any illusion that Washington and Israel are responsible for the formal devise of the peace process. In revealing to the world its hypocrisy on the Middle East, the U.S. has ensured both the Arab publics are infuriated and that the Palestinians will jump ship on the two-state solution. But there was one significant victory at the UN for Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, even if it was not the one he sought. He will not achieve statehood for his people at the world body, but he has fatally discredited the U.S. as the arbiter of a Middle East peace. In telling the Palestinian there was no shortcut to statehood after they have already waited for more than six decades for justice, the U.S. president revealed his country as incapable of offering moral leadership on the resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. If Obama is this craven to Israel, what better reception can the Palestinians hope to receive from a future U.S. leader? One guest at the UN had the nerve to politely point this out in his speech. Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president, who himself appears to be wavering from his original support for a Palestinian state, warned that U.S. control of the peace process needed to end. We must stop believing that a single country, even the largest or a small group of countries, can resolve so complex a problem, he told the General Assembly. His suggestion was for a more active role for Europe and the Arab states at peace with Israel. Sarkozy appeared to have overlooked the fact that the responsibility for solving the conflict was widened in much this way in 2002 with the creation of the Quartet, compromising the U.S., the European Union, Russia, and the United Nations. The Quartet's formation was necessary because the U.S. and Israel realized that the Palestinian leadership would not continue playing the peace process game if oversight remained exclusively with Washington, following the Palestinians' betrayal by President Bill Clinton at Camp David in 2000. The Quartet's job was to restore Palestinian faith in and buy a few more years for the Oslo process. However, the Quartet quickly discredited itself too, not least because its officials never strayed from the Israeli-Washington consensus. Last week, senior Palestinian negotiator Nabil Shaath spoke for most Palestinians when he accused the Quartet's envoy, Tony Blair, of sounding like an Israeli diplomat as he sought to dissuade Abbas from applying for statehood. And true to form, the quartet responded to the Palestinians' UN application by limply offering Abbas instead more of the same tired talks that have gone nowhere for two decades. The Palestinians' leadership's move to the UN, effectively bypassing the quartet, widens the circle of responsibility for Middle East peace yet further. It also neatly brings the Palestinian 63-year plight back to the world body. But Abbas's application also exposes the UN's powerlessness to intervene in an effective way. Statehood depends on a successful referral to the Security Council, which is dominated by the U.S. The General Assembly may be more sympathetic, but it cannot confer no more than a symbolic upgrading of Palestine's status, putting it on par with the Vatican. So the Palestinian leadership is stuck. Abbas has run out of institutional addresses for helping him to establish a state alongside Israel, and that means there is a third casualty of the statehood bid, the Palestinian Authority. The PA was the fruit of the Oslo process, and it will wither without its sustenance. Instead, we are entering a new phase of the conflict in which the U.S., Europe, and the UN will have only a marginal part to play. The Palestinian old guard are about to be challenged by a new generation that is tired of the formal structures of diplomacy that pander to Israel's interests only. The young, new Palestinian leaders are familiar with social media, are better able to equip to organize a popular mass movement, and refuse to be bound by the borders that encage their parents and grandparents. Their assessment is that the PA, and even the Palestinians' unrepresentative superbody, the PLO, are part of the problem, not the solution. Till now, they have remained largely deferential to their elders, but that trust is fast waning. Educated and alienated, they are looking for new answers to an old problem. They will not be seeking them from the countries and institutions that have repeatedly confirmed their complicity in sustaining the Palestinian people's misery. The new leaders will appeal over the heads of the gatekeepers, turning to the court of global public opinion. Polls show that in Europe and the U.S., ordinary people are far more sympathetic to the Palestinian cause than their governments. The first shoots of this revolution in Palestinian politics are evident in the youth movement that earlier this year frightened Abbas's Fatah party and Hamas into creating a semblance of unity. These youngsters, now shorn of the distracting illusion of Palestinian statehood, will redirect their energies into an anti-apartheid struggle, using the tools of nonviolent resistance and civil disobedience. Their rallying cry will be one person, one vote, and the single state Israel rules over. Global support will be translated into a rapid intensification of the boycott and sanctions movement. Israel's legitimacy and the credibility of its dubious claim to being a democracy are likely to take yet one more of a hammering. Events at the UN are creating a new clarity for Palestinians, reminding them that there can be no self-determination until they liberate themselves from the legacy of colonialism and the self-serving illusions of the aging notables who now lead them. The old men in their suits have had their day. And that's how Jonathan Cook's article on the epilogue to the UN bid ends. And as you can see, our faith is more in the generation of people like Rana and herself who are working with BDS and social media to galvanize a movement that finds a more just and lasting solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And as we come to the tail end of the show, I'd like to remind folks of the upcoming Boston Palestine Film Festival that begins on October 21st and runs through October 30th. We don't want you to miss the 10 unforgettable days of events related to Palestine. And the first film will be at the MFA, entitled The Time That Remains by director Ilyai Suleiman, and he'll also be in town. There'll be several other films by him as well. And since I have a few minutes here, I would actually like to read a bit of more of Rana's blogs here since we had her as a guest earlier today. And okay. I would like to read the last part of her blog entitled The European Union in Palestine, published just recently on September 21st. And it says, coincidentally, a few days ago, I was stirred by a comment from someone on a recent piece on my blog accusing me of yearning for the eradication of Israel. I think I should learn to accustom myself to such sort of accusations every time I speak in favor of a one state. Palestine is not Nazi Germany, and the eradication of Israel is not what Palestinians seek to achieve. It is not always right to use statements from history and try to identify them with the present. When Israeli Jews tend to play with history and assume a widespread anti-Semitic fanfare, this is because it serves their vile purposes, not because it applies to reality. The world we were born into did not provide us with many options. Everything is a difficult decision. Sometimes it's either you travel tomorrow or miss the scholarship forever, simply because it is an extraordinary opening of the Rafah crossing that is not likely to occur more often, even if it was your brother's wedding or the birth of your first child. Many people here subsist on charities, and many live in uninhabitable shacks. There are times when hundreds of frameless bodies and the fractured dreams they carry dive in sewage to the knees. They would invite neighbors to join them on the rooftops in order to avoid mosquitoes, a scorching weather, and an intolerable smell. On better occasions, when the only misfortune is a normal power outage, refugees pack the rooftops under the dim light of the moon to share stories and smoke hookah. The Lama, friendly Greek gathering, has always compensated for their wrenches and searing pains. A refugee's ultimate dream is to go back to the land on which his ancestors lived, respectable lives, and feed from the olive groves they cared for. Sometimes back into history, Palestinians and Jews lived side by side, shared meals, weddings, and religious ceremonies. There were times when Palestinians and Jews hoped for a better future alongside each other, sometime before the State of Israel was created and before hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were displaced across the countries to never return. And that's how Rana's blog on the UN bid ends. And this concludes our edition of This Week in Palestine, a 45-minute segment that is part of Truth and Justice Radio, airing on WZBC 90.3 from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. We hope you join us again next week for news and views from and about Palestine. إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر تسكنوا ماسا لون وطن تسكنه ماتا لون وطن نفقا لعودة اللاجئين.